Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
Author and journalist Ken Auletta has covered Hollywood and the media power game for The New Yorker for 30 years. While reporting a New Yorker profile of Harvey Weinstein in 2002, veteran journalist Ken Auletta received a tip that the Oscar-winning producer had sexually assaulted a young employee 4 years earlier. Five of Ken Auletta's first 12 books have been bestsellers. And for example, Three Blind Mice, How the TV Networks Lost Their Way. He's now written the Harvey Weinstein story he wanted to tell. This new biography is his 13th book, Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. Ken Auletta, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy.
This book was a very emotional read for me, and not just because of my gender, but it was sometimes funny. For example, when I look at a picture of Harvey Weinstein now, I remember the quote, "He looks like chewed bubblegum rolled in cat hair."
That was a Saturday Night Live put down.
Yeah. And yet most of it, though, just made me really mad, made me angry.
Made me angry about it.
I wondered how, because most biographers choose a subject that they like, and they spend a lot of time writing about this person that they like. But you did an awful lot of research on Harvey Weinstein, and how did you feel about him?
Well, I didn't like him. I thought he was a bully, and when I profiled him in 2002 in The New Yorker, in 20,000 words, I described him as such. Also described him as a very talented movie maker, but he hated the profile, and it was a profile of a bully, of a man who raged often out of control, yelled at people, sometimes got into physical fights. I had heard he had abused women, but as you said earlier, I couldn't get any woman on the record to say that. So I set out to write a biography of a man who I don't like. And that was a fascinating challenge. If you determine not to write about it, to create a stick figure, a one-dimensional character, if you look at Harvey's life, you have to say Harvey Weinstein, Shakespeare in Love, My Left Foot, Crying Game, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, the galaxy of movies that he made are extraordinary. And obviously you had talent to be able to do that. And you want to be able to explore that. So if you do that, you're not writing about a stick figure anymore. And yet the discipline that it took to be able to describe his virtues when you're overwhelmed by a sense of his vices was really an interesting challenge for me.
Well, you know, I hesitate even to put the label biography on this book you wrote, because it is a report about him, Harvey Weinstein, but it's also about Hollywood and power. And I felt the subject of your book, too, was power. And because he knew how to play power and people.
And I keep on thinking the best books I've ever read on power were Robert Caro's books, first on Robert Moses and then on his four biographies of Lyndon Johnson. So far, he's got one more to go. And they're just brilliant expositions of power and how it's used and abused. And Harvey was a master manipulator of people and of the power he had attained. And people were afraid of him, and he knew that, and he used that fear. By the way, Donald Trump understood or believed that the key to power was fear. And I think Harvey was similar in that regard. He believed that the key to his power was people would fear him. They would fear he would sue them. They would fear he would expose them in the press. They would fear that he would, you know, do something that would harm them in some way, including physical harm. And so Harvey was very much a central part of this book is power and how he used it and abused it. And how Hollywood allowed him for more than four decades to get away with that. And that's the culture of silence that I refer to in the subtitle.
Well, it seems that was just kind of accepted back in, say, the 50s and 60s. The casting couch was, that's just the way it is in Hollywood.
But you know, there's a difference, Nancy, between the casting couch, and I go into this in the book, directors, studio heads who take advantage of a young, attractive woman who wants a role in a Hollywood movie or a job in a Hollywood studio and basically seduce them. But there's a difference between seduction and rape. Harvey was raping his woman violently. And since he was exposed in October of 2017, more than 100 women have come forth to say that Harvey physically assaulted me. And that's not the casting couch.
My guest is best-selling author Ken Auletta. His newest book is Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. Since this is a book show, I'd like for you, if you don't mind, to read the first paragraph of your prologue, Ken.
Be happy to. Once he exuded power. Films he produced and distributed garnered 81 Academy Awards and 341 Oscar nominations. Only Steven Spielberg was thanked more often from the awards stage. He boasted of his friendships with President Clinton and Obama, and of the famous actresses he claimed to have bedded. Inside the office, he terrified the four assistants who serviced his needs, and he bellowed at most of his executives. Outside the office, he flashed a dazzling cap-toothed smile while strolling hundreds of red carpets, trailed by clicking cameras, often accompanied by a second wife, fashion designer Georgina Chapman, who dressed some of the stars lit by the paparazzi flashes. He was that rare Hollywood figure known instantly by his first name, Harvey.
This is journalist Ken Auletta reading from his 13th book, Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. Now, you mentioned in that first paragraph, his second wife, who was a fashion designer, Georgina Chapman, and he promoted her because he'd have his actresses wear her clothes when they'd walk the red carpet. Is that true?
Indeed, it's true. And there were some, Jennifer Aniston being an exception, who refused to wear her clothes, thinking they were not appropriate for her style. But nevertheless, Georgina Chapman, very successful. Marchese is the brand name. Very successful fashion designer. And Harvey did induce many of the female stars of his movies to wear her clothes.
Well, people must be wondering, where was his wife in all this, when all this was going on? And you say that this was his second wife. How did he get away with it?
The same question applies to his first wife. I asked this question. They would not talk to me. Harvey has a non-disclosure agreement that he entered with both his former wives, and he signed it as well. Neither of the three of them can speak about the other. They're not allowed to. So the wives would not talk to me, but their friends did. And their friends all said to me the same thing. They had no idea he was cheating on them. They thought he was a loving husband. He certainly was a good father. My reporting says reports that he was a good, attentive father. But how could a man who, when he was in New York, where they lived, he and his wives lived, would get a hotel suite, usually three nights a week, and have women ferried up to the hotel suite where he would have sex or rape them. So he's coming home late. How is the wives never suspected the husband? I mean, it puzzled me, but friends and of theirs say they didn't suspect it.
Well, let's fast forward to 2020. And would you please read us the second paragraph in your prologue?
Be happy to. The gray concrete sidewalk Harvey Weinstein crossed daily in the winter of 2020 was not a red carpet, but a gauntlet. Waiting for him to arrive at the criminal court building at 100 Center Street were armed police officers and metal police barricades corralling a throng of reporters who did not adhere to the respectful protocols of a Hollywood opening. Because of his recent back surgery, when his black Cadillac Escalade braked in front of the New York State Supreme Court building, Harvey had to be helped out of the back seat by two burly men. He slowly shuffled in black orthopedic shoes towards the building's entrance, 100 or so feet away, on a four-wheel walker, trailed by his team of lawyers and public relations advisors. Harvey did not pause and rarely looked up to respond to shouted questions or to smile for the cameras. Once inside the building, he dutifully emptied his pockets and passed through a metal detector. An elevator whisked Harvey and his entourage to the 15th floor. We passed the second gauntlet of cameras and reporters before entering courtroom 1530 for his criminal trial for predatory rape and sexual assault.
This is bestselling author and journalist Ken Auletta, and he's reading from his 13th book, Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. Now, when we see that, because we've seen video, I think most people saw that video of him getting out of the car and struggling to walk in with it. Oh, yeah, an act. He's trying to get sympathy. But when I read your book, I thought, gosh, he really was in bad shape.
I covered his trial every day, and I watched him walk initially in 2020 and into the initially in 2018 and then into 2019. He walked with a limp and sometimes with a cane. He didn't have a walker, but he had by 2020, he had these two burly guys holding him under the arms, helping transport him into the courtroom. And then soon after, he had a walker that he rolled himself in the courtroom. And if you watched his right foot, as I did, he couldn't put it down on the ground. It wouldn't hold him up. And that was his problem. He had stenosis. And he had an operation days before the trial began in January of 2020. And it was not a success. And eventually, like today, he's actually in a wheelchair. So the notion that the prosecution spread, and many people who are aware of how Harvey Weinstein would lie oftentimes, they believe that it was fake. It wasn't fake. He was, and in addition to being in a wheelchair, he has a stent in his heart. He had a heart procedure after he was sentenced. He has really severe diabetes, despite the fact that he eats chocolate or has eaten chocolate most of his life.
In fact, I think you say he's on almost 20 medications.
He takes 20 pills a day, according to his former staffers. And so he's in terrible shape physically. And his lawyer, before the sentencing on March 11th, 2020, said to the judge, I hope you will not give him what the prosecution was asking for, which was 30 years, because Harvey won't live that long.
Well, you helped accelerate the downfall of Harvey Weinstein, but there are three people who reveal the truth, and one of them was Ronan Farrow. And what role did he play?
Well, not just Ronan Farrow, but the two Times reporters, Jody Cantor and Meg Toohey, they exposed him in October of 2017. They succeeded where I had not in 2002 in getting the women to overcome their fears and to speak, and all credit to them for doing that. Ronan was then at NBC initially when he came to me in the fall, in the spring of 2017, and said, could he have access to my interview papers that are on file at the New York Public Library. I gave him that access. He then called me and said, can I interview you? I said, sure. So he interviews me for 3 or 4 hours. And in the course of that interview, I say, so what do you have? And he said, and he gave me the following answer, which literally almost knocked me off my chair. He said, I have three women on camera asserting that Harvey abused them. I have five women on camera, but shielded, their names not disclosed, saying that Harvey abused them. And I have the audio tape, the Italian model, the police had wired her in 2015, where Harvey acknowledged that he had abused her. I said, my God, you've broken the case. What's the next step? And Ronan says, well, I meet with the president of NBC News on August 8th. I said, great. And then on August 9th, I called him. I said, Ronan, so how'd you do with your meeting? Because I thought, finally, this case is going to be broken. I knew the Times was working on something, but I had no contact with them, but I did with Ronan. So he said, they killed my story. I'm no longer working at NBC. I can take
now
it.
Here's a place too where I, as a reader, this made me mad.
it should have made it made me mad.
Gosh.
And my only role then was to introduce him to the editor of the New Yorker, telling the editor I thought Ronan Farrow had broken the case, and Ronan took it from there, and the New Yorker took it from there. I was not part of that. And he did a brilliant job, as the two Times reporters. The two Times reporters came out a week before Ronan came out, but together the two pieces of work were profoundly important and compelled the company to fire Harvey Weinstein. Actually compelled his brother, Bob Weinstein, his closest associate and business partner, to provide the key vote to fire Harvey Weinstein.
We're going to take a break. And the book that we're talking about is The Fall of Harvey Weinstein by Ken Auletta. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is author Ken Auletta, and he's written the sordid story of Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. In fact, through the book, usually authors use the last name to talk about Weinstein, but you called him Harvey through your book, and I'm guessing it's because he had a brother that was also a Weinstein, and you interviewed him. But now, before we get to his brother, I want to go back to Ronan Farrow, in case listeners don't know who Ronan Farrow is and why he might have a special interest in this case.
Well, Ronan Farrow is the son of Woody Allen. And he came out against Woody Allen, claiming that he abused Ronan's sister. And of course, there was a huge hullabaloo about this, and it has haunted Woody Allen. But Ronan forcefully made that case. But when he came to me, I didn't know Ronan Farrow. I'm a journalist. And when Ronan Farrow came to me, one of the questions in my mind, is Ronan Farrow a journalist or a zealot? Is he someone on a cause here? And therefore, maybe he won't be judicious and won't carefully sort out the facts. But what I found in talking to him both the first time when he called and also when he came to interview me was that he was judicious, that he was acting like a journalist. He's also a lawyer. He's a brilliant young man. I mean, he's a guy who graduated college, you know, as a teenager. And so I had a lot of confidence in Ronan Farrow, and I think it's been justified.
My guest is journalist and best-selling author Ken Auletta. And his newest book is Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. And you go into the trial when these people come forth and you have the evidence now. So it goes to trial, and he's a tough client. And I was kind of amused that when you have scenes from Harvey's criminal trial, that one of his attorneys commuted daily to Manhattan in a chauffeured Lincoln Continental. And I don't know if people are familiar with the Lincoln Lawyer series, but I found that very, the scenes from the criminal trial, very interesting. You did a tremendous amount of research for this book, Ken.
Well, I must say, I found the trial enthralling. I mean, I've covered one other trial extensively, and that was the Microsoft antitrust trial in federal court back in 2000. This was the first criminal trial where I was every day there. And I just found it fascinating. One of the interesting challenges for the prosecution, and one of the reasons why prosecutors don't often bring cases like this, is when you have women who claim to have been victims of Harvey Weinstein, and yet some of them kept in touch with them. And some of them actually had consensual sex with them afterwards.
That was hard to believe.
Could the prosecution overcome that and win the case? And one of the successful things the prosecution did was they called to the stand Dr. Barbara Ziv, who teaches a professor at Temple, who's an expert on rape victims. And she said, one of the things she testified was that 40% of the women who are rape victims keep in touch and often have continued relationships with their rapist. And there are multiple reasons for that. And she went through it, as did the prosecution, throughout the trial, as they introduced and quizzed the women. The women were afraid. The women were in denial. The women didn't want people to know. The women thought that Harvey would sue them. The women said maybe it didn't happen. There are all sorts of reasons that race through a victim's mind that kind of blur what happened or exacerbate what happened to exacerbate fear. And they successfully made that point where the jury could believe it. So even though some of the women continued to see Harvey or praise him, and therefore could be accused of being overly ambitious and willing to sacrifice their body for their career. Nevertheless, they believe that these women were assaulted, physically assaulted, raped by Harvey Weinstein, and therefore they convicted him. And that's a message that carries forth to other district attorney's offices. Harvey's on trial, will be on trial this October in Los Angeles, because the prosecutor there is dealing with some of the same issues. Some of the women will have had continued relationships with Harvey Weinstein after he abused them. And yet they're betting that, like in the New York court, the jury can see through that.
Well, we also, as a reader, I felt sympathy for a Black lawyer on Harvey's legal team, Black lawyer named Sullivan, who was vilified.
Yeah, Sullivan is a professor of law at Harvard, and the students, he was a resident advisor, so he had housing where students were part of his housing, and his job was to mentor them. And the students protested, saying that they don't want to be mentored by someone who would represent a sleaze like Harvey Weinstein. And he tried to defend himself by saying, properly, I think, that the court, you know, a lawyer, that's a lawyer's job to defend people. And I'm not, you can't accuse me of being supporting a rapist or rapists. I'm supporting the law. And nevertheless, Harvard rid him of his job. He's still on the faculty, but he's no longer has housing and in charge of students. I think wrongly, by the way.
Well, somebody described Harvey Weinstein as the worst person I ever met. And I think a lot of people shared that opinion. The worst person I ever met.
Yeah, he was, you know, Ben Rathman, who was arguably the city's foremost criminal attorney, was his first attorney. And Harvey would constantly call him at all hours of the night, yelling, at one point telling him, "You should work for nothing. This is great publicity," representing Harvey Weinstein. And Ben Rathman shot back at him, "Harvey, what do I need publicity? I get $1,500 an hour to represent people, and I have lots of clients." You know, in the end, he ended the relationship with Harvey Weinstein because the yelling was so intense. But that's Harvey. I mean, Harvey was really unpleasant person to be in the same room with at times. I mean, he could be charming. He could do great movies, but he tended to
He was so talented in that regard.
But part of Harvey's MO was conquest. And that's what he was doing with women, but that's what he was doing when he yelled at people. That's what he was doing when he told his lawyer he should work for nothing. He wanted to conquer them. And something in his psyche made that a need. And what that was, I don't know, but it certainly plays out. You see it repeatedly as you follow Harvey Weinstein.
Well, I wondered too about the voting of the Academy, that why his movies won, and what was he doing behind the scenes to ensure that his movie, instead of say Saving Private Ryan, because he denigrated that movie and put it out there that, oh, this is, no, the first few minutes are worth watching, but then this is not worth watching. And he would do things like that, start rumors, and it made me wonder what goes on behind the scenes when they're awarding the Oscars.
Harvey was brilliant at making campaigns for Oscars similar to campaigns for political office. He would spend enormous amounts of money. He would spread rumors about the films he was competing against, as you said, Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg's movie. Harvey denied to me that he said it was a boring movie, but the president of his company acknowledged to me that that's the weapon, the verbal weapon they were using against Saving Private Ryan. So Harvey did this thuggish campaign, and his movie, Shakespeare in Love, won the best picture that year against Saving Private Ryan. And there's no question that Harvey was guilty of underhanded tactics to win that award, even though he did a wonderful movie.
Well, you conclude your book, the very last chapter, you say Rosebud? And what did you mean by that, Ken?
Well, it goes back to Citizen Kane, that famous movie where is there a single explanation for the beastly behavior we've just witnessed? I conclude there is not a single. There are multiple explanations. Certainly, Miriam Weinstein, the mother, had some impact on Harvey's yelling and volatile behavior. But she didn't make Harvey a sexual monster. And I became convinced in the research I did and talking to psychiatrists and people who are expert in this field that Harvey is a sociopath, that there are three definitions that usually define a sociopath. One is lack of guilt. Harvey certainly had no guilt. Two is lack of empathy for the people he was victimizing. Harvey displayed none of that. And the third is narcissism. And Harvey clearly was that. Now you can have all three of those characteristics and not be a sexual beast the way Harvey was. But nevertheless, he was, and he certainly fulfills those three criteria.
Well, I am quite a fan of the profiles in The New Yorker, and a lot of the times when I read that, I change my opinion, or it fortifies my opinion of the person. And you list other men who were accused of sexual impropriety. And I read the profile, this was back in 2019, of Al Franken. And it was entitled The Case of Al Franken, A Closer Look at the Accusations Against the Former Senator. And he resigned amid these accusations. And after I read that, I thought, even though I'm so glad the Me Too movement came along to encourage women to come out and not remain silent, this culture of silence, but I also encourage people to read the profiles in The New Yorker to really get at the picture that are not presented in, say, the three news networks. I'm alluding now somewhat to your previous book.
I agree with you. I quote from that Jane Mayer profile, actually, and mm-hmm. One of the things that's happened is that if you look at sexual abuse, Harvey Weinstein is at one end of the continuum. He's the extreme case. Al Franken is all the way on the other side. We shouldn't be grouping the Al Frankens and some of the other people with Harvey Weinstein. We ought to be able to discuss gradations of people. And if someone did something wrong, as Franken did, and apologizes, and seemingly they're contrite, that sincere, we all believe in pardons for people who, and we should believe in them for human beings in this case as well. And unfortunately, you get a death sentence in our society today if you abuse a woman. Harvey deserves that sentence, but some other people don't deserve that severe sentence. They may have had a misdemeanor, not a felony.
Yeah.
He overreacted.
Well, we haven't heard the last of this story, Mr. Auletta. A movie's coming out, I understand, she said. So somebody said it's more important than all the president's men, this movie that's coming out. So I think people would really, if they want to know, maybe not the whole story, I don't know if that can ever be known, but a well-researched story, they should pick up a copy of your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy, for having me.
I'd like to remind listeners, Ken Auletta is a journalist whose recent book is Hollywood Ending, Harvey Weinstein and the Culture of Silence. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll be with co-host of Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, who has written the story of John Fremont and his wife, Jessie. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is host of NPR's Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep, who has written a book about how John C. Fremont and his wife Jessie helped cause the Civil War. The book that you wrote, Imperfect Union, How Jessie and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War, was such a fascinating book for me. I had a personal connection to a lot of what you had to say. But there was so much I had never known. So how did you get interested in this topic?
I'd read about them ever since I was a kid because I read books about the Old West and books about the Civil War, and they appear in those books again and again and again. But they're not often treated very deeply. They're minor characters described as very famous, very ambitious, even very vain, making a lot of mistakes along the way. And so you learn bits about them, but I didn't know them deeply until much more recently. In recent years, I've been writing about the westward expansion of the United States. I wrote this book called Jackson Land, about Andrew Jackson, the president, and a Cherokee leader, John Ross, and their battle for more than 20 years over expelling Cherokees from their land in the eastern United States and moving them west of the Mississippi. That was an early phase of America's westward expansion. And when that project was done, I wanted to explore what happened next, the capture of the West and the Pacific Coast. And John and Jesse Fremont, both of them, were central figures in that story. John was a Western explorer who went out and mapped the Oregon Trail and went to Mexican-controlled California and even helped take it over. As an explorer, he did not discover that much that was so new. But he did go back to Washington, where he was based, and write best-selling accounts of his adventures. And in a sense, that, along with the maps, was the point. His mission was to publicize the West, to entice people to move along the Oregon Trail and settle the Oregon country near the Pacific coast, because that was the way the United States would take that land over, was through settlement. That was the point, and he, with Jesse's help, was a brilliant publicist, it turned out. They collectively were good publicists, and while making the West more famous, they also made themselves very famous.
Well, now, you mentioned Jesse just now, and when I first encountered Jesse and John Fremont, I thought, oh, John had a brother named Jesse.
Ah.
And then I discover, no, this is a woman, his wife. How did she get the name Jesse?
It's fascinating. She was the daughter of a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, who had a daughter and then expected the next child to be a son and appeared to be all ready to name the son after his father, Jesse. Turned out to be a daughter instead, but he was a stubborn guy, so he changed the spelling slightly, J-E-S-S-I-E, and went with that name. So he effectively gave her a boy's name, or what sounded like a boy's name. And Jesse wrote in a memoir many years later, "My father gave me early the place a son would have had. In the absence of a son, he didn't have one until later, he took her along hunting with him. She was devoted to him, and she would carry the game bag in which there might be a dead bird that he had just shot. And she would trail along after him in Washington when he went to work at the Senate, and he would leave her at the Library of Congress for safekeeping. And she would even trail along with him to meet presidents, starting with President Andrew Jackson. She grew up, in a sense, as a boy would, doing things that boys were supposed to be doing. And she wanted to do more of that. She wanted to be involved in politics. She wanted to be involved in her father's work of encouraging the settlement of the West. She wasn't allowed to because she was the wrong gender for the time. But she ultimately found a way to be her father's assistant and also to work with her father through her husband, who assisted her father's work through his explorations."
Well, I want to repeat her father's name as a senator, Thomas Hart Benton, because that name was very familiar, but I didn't know that the Thomas Hart Benton that we all know as a painter was a descendant of Jesse Fremont's father.
That's absolutely correct. They had the same name, and the painter is probably a little more famous today. But in the 1840s and 50s, and a little bit before that, Thomas Hart Benton, the senator, was a giant figure. He was one of Missouri's first two senators when it became a state in 1821, and he spent 30 years in the United States Senate. He was among the founders of the Democratic Party. He was a political giant with an opinion on every topic. He had an ability to give speeches for hours and hours. He had taught himself multiple languages. He was very erudite. He was also in many ways an awful person who owned slaves, just to give one example, and who killed a man in a duel once. In many ways, an appalling individual, and yet also a very talented lawmaker and senator who passed on a lot of his knowledge to his daughter.
Well, we know a good bit about Jesse's father, but what do we know about John Fremont's father?
Very little, except that he was a French immigrant. John Charles Fremont's father, who had a slightly different spelling to his name, by the way, fell in love with a Virginia aristocrat, and even though she was unable to get a divorce, they ran away together to Savannah, Georgia, where John was born. They then moved around the South, and the father died when John was very young, about 5 years old. And from that time on, the family was relatively poor. The mother had some of her inheritance she was able to claim, but they were a little short of money and living in Charleston, South Carolina. And so he began life as this penniless young man doing various things and trying to find his way in the world. He ultimately worked his way into the United States Army. He got a lieutenant's commission. He was part of something called the Army Corps of Topographical Engineers, which was supposed to map the West, among other places. And that was his early work, which was not work that would bring him great distinction necessarily, except for the fact that he met and eloped with this senator's daughter, who gave him access to the political connections and the media connections that were necessary to become a celebrity.
Well, you mentioned his born in Savannah and living in Charleston, and I was excited that he went to the College of Charleston because I spent a year teaching there.
Oh, okay.
So I have a personal connection to a lot of these places. I lived in the mountains where the Cherokees lived, and It was called Enota, the Enchanted Valley. That's what it meant in Cherokee. So a lot of this book was just touched me personally. But now, so that people, I mentioned that he went to the College of Charleston. He was not an ignoramus. He was a very smart guy, and I was impressed that he knew Greek, because when he saw the Golden Gate here in California, he thought of a Greek word.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. He's the guy who gave the name Golden Gate to the mouth of San Francisco Bay, and it was a play off of the Golden Horn, which was the name of a bit of a waterway, a trading port for the ancient city of Constantinople, now Istanbul, Constantinople and Istanbul, all the same city. That was the city where the ancient Romans conducted their trade with Asia, and that's why he called it the Golden Gate. I always thought that Golden Gate meant that San Francisco Bay was the golden entryway to California, but I was looking in the wrong direction. Fremont was looking outward. It was a golden portal outward to the Pacific and to Asia, and an opportunity for the United States to have its own direct trading routes with India and with China. He was playing off of the vision of Senator Benton, who had wanted this kind of a trading port in the Pacific for a long time. And he was looking forward in many ways to the world we have today, where the most important economic relationship, single relationship, probably is across the Pacific from America to China.
Well, you know, I'm amused that you said that, because that's precisely my own idea. I didn't realize it was that the Golden Gate was the entry into the harbor, and he was looking the other direction to Asia. It seems like that everything I read about him, John Fremont had impeccable timing. And typically he's known, I think, as the leading explorer of the 19th century. But all these other things, he was on the scene of so much that was going on in the United States, this new country.
Yeah, it's just amazing. And it's one of the reasons that he appears in surely thousands and thousands of history books, just never, or rarely, I should say, explored in great depth. There are only a relative few biographies about him over the last 150 or 160 years that have been written. But he's in thousands of books because he was involved in so much. He was involved in westward expansion. He was involved in the United States war with Mexico, which was part of that expansion, involved in the Oregon Trail and the acquisition of Oregon by the United States, involved in the creation of the Republican Party in the years before the Civil War. That gave him a role in causing the Civil War, bringing it about, because the Republican Party's creation was something that was seen as profoundly threatening to the South and is ultimately the reason the South left the Union and fired the first shot of the Civil War. He was then involved in the Civil War as a general, and he was fired by Abraham Lincoln, later challenged Lincoln for the presidency briefly in 1864, and even after the war, he was involved in transcontinental railroads. It was an epic, epic life that he lived, in large measure because he had Jesse Benton Fremont to fill in some of his shortcomings or inadequacies and to help him publicize himself and defend himself politically and do things that needed to be done. She was a huge part of the story, too.
Well, the very cover of the title of your book, the last few words, that Jesse and John Fremont helped cause the Civil War, that was intriguing to me.
Yeah, it is amazing. But it's just right there. It's in the creation of the Republican Party. There was this dramatic change going on in the United States at the time. It was a change in demographics. The North and South were divided over slavery. Northern states had gradually abolished slavery. Southern states ever more firmly embraced it. And any national political party tried to stay quiet on slavery for many, many years. They didn't want to offend anybody. They needed Southern votes in order to assemble an electoral majority, which meant they couldn't say anything against slavery even if they wanted to. Well, but then that changed because there was a change in population. The North grew in population much more rapidly, which gave them more power. And suddenly there was this party, the Republican Party in the North, that had a chance to win the presidency with Northern votes alone, which was very destabilizing.
Well, I was intrigued by that, too, because I hear a lot of reasons for the Civil War, but this shed new light on it. And I found that fascinating, Steve.
Well, I appreciate that, and I especially appreciate it because it relates to today, when we're also going through demographic changes that can be seen as profoundly destabilizing. And it's one of the underlying realities of our politics. When you ask about why our politics are so bitter, it's because you do have people who fear not just losing an election, but losing for all time. President Trump told his supporters in 2016, "This is your last chance to win." because of the demographic changes in the country, which he was going to stop. That's a thing that he explicitly said. Now we also have Democrats and more progressive people who fear being shut out of power forever because of the way the president is appointing conservative justices to lifetime appointments, and also treating the presidency in a certain way and is seen as trampling many rules or seen as authoritarian. This is the underlying cause, I think, of a lot of the tension and the bitterness of our politics. People feel the stakes are very, very, very high.
Well, I want to thank you for writing this book, Steve. I found it so fascinating. I may not be your typical reader because of my own personal connections with this, but thank you for writing this book, Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War.
Oh, I'm glad to have done it. Thanks for the invitation.
And now Richard Parker has some thoughts on the war between the states.
Robert E. Lee surrendered his sword at Appomattox on the 9th of April, 1869. This is believed to be a historical fact by many and a piece of typical Yankee-inspired fiction by others. These latter reside almost exclusively south of the Mason-Dixon line, of course, where I grew up and where my brother still lives. Not only do these Southern non-believers not believe that the Union Army won the war, many of them don't believe that the war is over. There's been a truce of sorts, sure, but there are Southern boys who are sure that the Articles of Surrender were a clever ploy by General Lee to distract the Union officer corps while he urged his soldiers to slink out of Virginia while the slinking was good. Now, of course, my brother, a moderately educated person, doesn't believe all that, but you wouldn't know it from watching him for a while. He's a charter member of the 33 and a third Arkansas Irregulars, and he's fully equipped for the role. He has a complete Confederate uniform, sewed up by our late sainted mother, and complete with a gray kepi-style cap he made himself. He fires a muzzle-loader rifle that fires a 50-caliber round ball with amazing accuracy. In fact, he was the state muzzleloader champion a couple of decades ago. He also built a small-scale Civil War-era cannon that fires a 1-inch lead ball nearly a mile. Now, Brother Michael is mainly in it for the amusement, I'm pretty sure, but he's serious about his amusement. While we're at it, let me be serious for just a minute. When I was in high school in Hot Springs, Arkansas, I played in the band. At football games, there was a tune we played at every game that made the fans nuts. It was called South. And the first part of it was a call and response that involved a cheer for the team. But then, after a drum cadence, we broke into a spirited version of Dixie, and the whole stadium stood up and went mildly crazy. It was still like that in that part of the world even well into the 60s. Memories of my younger years in the 1950s include images from the local JCPenney's store, where there were two water fountains side by side and two men's and two women's restrooms. You know the reason for this ridiculous duplication. It dates from the years of Reconstruction, during which time the North really did give the South something to be resentful about, and the hundred years of Jim Crow laws that followed that. Many of those laws were in effect until the 1960s, including the ones that justified all that extra plumbing at the Penney's store. Well, racial matters were not the only things at stake during the Civil War. There were and are Southerners today who claim that slavery was not really the issue. The issue was states' rights. But, and however, the main right the Southern states wanted to hold onto was the right to own slaves. So it goes around, and then it comes around. Racism these days is different. African Americans are discouraged from voting not because of their race so much, but because of the way they might vote. I'm not so sure that this is progress. Well, good grief, I was serious for more than a minute. That may be some kind of record, and it hardly hurt at all. I'll try it again soon. Meantime, this is Richard Parker.
Thank you, Richard. And now a commentary by essayist Anthony Peyton Porter.
Direction. I am without direction. That doesn't mean I have no burning quest that propels my life and fires my soul. Maybe like sending Doug LaMalfa to Mars or achieving democracy in the United States. I no longer have such an overriding objective because I've achieved it, and now I'm taking it easy. My goal was to change the world, and your listening to this confirms my success. In this context, without direction means that I have no sense of direction in a cardinal sense. Not the bird, which California could use a lot more of, by the way. North, south, east, and west, the cardinal directions. As a young man, I always knew where I was, because I was in Chicago, where west is west and a compass points smack down the middle of State Street. Not only that, all street numbers start at the same place and proceed in all directions at the same pace, 800 numbers per mile. 2400 West was as far from State Street as 2400 East, namely 3 miles. Nowhere else I've been is as easy to get around in as Chicago, and that early experience spoiled me. St. Paul and Minneapolis exist because of the Mississippi River, which doesn't know from cardinal directions, and streets tend to dash off in unexpected directions from the river or in a mad rush to get to it and abruptly disappear into a river road. Chico's orientation to Highway 99 has made its grid align with the highway's northwesterly rush to get away from Sacramento, a common sentiment in Northern California. Some intrepid neighborhoods have managed cardinal alignment, but they are few and obscure. Chico's planners, or the naming contingent anyway, also apparently loved nothing more than randomly renaming a street, whether it required it or not. I know of no other place where a person can travel on a street with so many names. Fair, Mulberry, Cypress, Mangrove, and Cohasset, for instance, and never need a turn signal. It's quite an achievement and confusing for a newbie. Most of the time, I carry a compass. Not many people carry a compass, it seems. Everyone who's seen me consult one of mine has been amazed and amused that I have such a thing on me. They're probably amused at other prostheses, too. I don't mind being confused, but I don't have the energy for much wandering around, and a compass keeps me from veering far off my optimum heading. In any new place, I first imagine it on Chicago's grid, like comparing women to my mother, but without the therapy. I'm Anthony Peyton Porter.
I'd also like to thank journalist and writer Ken Auletta, author of Hollywood Ending, and also NPR co-host Steve Inskeep.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.